You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/kidsandfamily. Just go to Indeed.com/kidsandfamily right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
When we started writing our thoughts down on paper, it opened up endless possibilities. Ideas could grow beyond the borders of the mind, and it changed the world. Somewhere along the way, we lost touch with paper, distracted by devices made for every purpose except for thinking and focus. On edge, waiting for the next notification. But what if new technology didn't pull us away from paper, but brought us closer to it? Listen. That's not paper. It's the sound of the new Remarkable Paper Pro, rewriting the future. A paper tablet with a true color ink display, gentle reading light, and unheard of tactility. With digital features for taking notes, thinking, and organizing, without any distractions. Paper is about to change the world again. Get your paper tablet at Remarkable.com today.
This podcast is sponsored by IQBar. Your favorite clean, functional, delicious nutrition brand is raising the bar with a little help from Thomas Keller, Michelin star chef of the French Laundry. IQBar and Thomas Keller have teamed up to create a salted caramel chip protein bar and yuzu mango hydration mix. With toasted macadamia nuts, rich caramel flavor, and brain-boosting nutrients, this bar is like having a Michelin star meal in your pocket. Pair it with the taste bud tingling yuzu mango IQ mix hydration mix, packed with magnesium and adaptogens to improve clarity and mood. With Keller's culinary excellence and IQ Bar's commitment to great taste and clean ingredients, this limited edition collaboration is simply mwah. And the best part is that 10% of sales go directly to Chef Keller's nonprofit, Mentor, that supports aspiring young chefs. Great taste, great nutrition, great mission. Go to IQBar.com today and enter promo code KELLER20 to get 20% off all IQ Bar products plus free shipping. That's IQBAR.com, promo code KELLER20.
Hey, hope you're enjoying the Grave Talks. Each and every week, we're now giving you two brand new episodes every Monday and Tuesday. Today and every Wednesday, we're going to flash back to some of our favorite interviews of the past. To listen to our complete archive of episodes, along with commercial-free advanced episodes of the show months before they're released to the public, become a Gravekeeper. That's a supporter of our show. It's only $5. You sign up now at patreon.com/thegravetalks or follow the links at thegravetalks.com. Today on The Grave Talks, the haunted St. Vincent Academy. What exactly went on behind the walls of the former St. Vincent Academy, a Catholic orphanage in western Kentucky? What still lurks behind those very walls today? On today's episode of The Grave Talks, we talk with paranormal investigator Stephen Asher about his time investigating St. Vincent Academy and the community that stands around it. A community that's filled with kind, honest, down-to-earth people who've been experiencing heavy paranormal activity for generations. Why is it that this area is such a hotbed of paranormal situations? Who are the souls that still linger day in and day out, and what do they want? There's much more to the activity in this area beyond just St. Vincent Academy.
Well, the thing about St. Vincent's is, a quick preface.
Yeah.
Each book of the Hauntings of series, as far back as Hauntings of the Kentucky State Penitentiary and Hauntings of the Western Lunatic Asylum, each one came at it from a different angle and had different elements, as well as the Hauntings of the St. Vincent's Academy. what sort of set St. Vincent's Academy apart from the previous two is that this this area was settled, and I believe it was 1812, and the St. Vincent's Academy come around shortly thereafter, officially, I believe, in 1820. And at this time, it was still pretty much frontier. Kentucky, people think of Kentucky, you know, horse racing, bourbon, trailer parks, and like people on cops. But back in the day, it was a wild and woolly place, you know, still. And most people didn't go there. A lot of the Native Americans used it as hunting grounds. It was sacred, but it was also, it was like you know, you respect it, but you also fear it because, you know, of supposed spirits and things and just a strange land where strange things happened. And the thing about, again, about the book, St. Vincent's Academy, the hauntings of it, is that the people who settled there were the Sisters of Mercy of Nazarene, and they really were the lifeblood of the community, and that really took root. And so there was, you know, St. Anne's Church, there was St. Vincent's Academy, there was Higgins Learning Center. There's just a multitude of different things in the town it's from and around the town it's from, which is Morganfield, Kentucky, and which is in Union County, which is northwestern Kentucky. And this tied in with just, you know, different locations because there was so much going on there. Sure. That was one of the big reasons I decided to do that, was because, you know, you would have hauntings and you'd also have, you know, haunting type legends or strange type folklore. And then you would have the Hart brothers, which was actually America's first serial killers. Now, they weren't American by birth. They were actually Scottish mercenaries sent by the crown to terrorize the Union or the colonial homesteads that were not, you know, doing what the crown liked. And they would go there and they were allowed to basically kind of have carte blanche, and they could go and rob people. They could attack people. They could kill people. They had rape gangs. You know, I mean, it's a bad bunch of boys when you literally have a group just there for demoralization and, you know, raping of women.
Sure.
And so, yeah, I mean, it was so much was tied into it that I had to include it all, because I don't feel that I would have really gave the area its credit, which is a beautiful area. It's you know, a lot of it's very rustic, and by having it in sort of a rustic area, a lot of times things don't necessarily change a whole lot. I mean, don't get me wrong, it's changed since 1820s, but you know, a lot of the old folklore and a lot of some of that true grit of the people were still there. And that's what I found so fascinating, is that when I started talking to people and they kind of learned of my other books, and some of them actually knew of it, which was really humbling. They see how I approach writing, how I approach storytelling, how I approach research, and I always try to do it again in a very respectful manner. And I'm not trying to exploit anything. I'm just, sometimes the story is so good. But it's a thing, you know, obviously you want to be respectful, mm-hmm. and always present it as neutral a light as possible. You know, I try not to cast judgment other than, you know, you rape gangs aren't good kids. Let's just say that.
Sure. When you were there and you were doing some research and you were talking to the folks, was there any hesitation for them to like come out of their shell a little bit to talk about some of the history and in some of, I mean, it's obviously not that bright of a history when you have some of those things in your community that are there, that are just facts. But, you know, sometimes when it is the past, it's, you know, kind of hush hush. We don't talk about that. That's a sad part. You know, was it difficult to get some of this out?
Yeah. One of the things that drew me to want to interview or do interviews and speak with people was that, and I always have to be careful not to use actual names. I'd spoken to a lady that I'm calling Tanya, who had worked in and with the facility. Let's just say it like that. Mm-hmm. And her husband had worked with me in regards of back when I was a guard years ago. Mm-hmm. And anyway, so this is where I started getting stories. And a lot of the stories came from Higgins Learning Center. And in this book, it actually has a chapter where we went through, we had, you know, all of our gear, we set up, we did, you know, EVP work, you know, all that different stuff. And we had some different things that happened, and door slamming, whatnot. You're hearing, you know, yells and screams out of nowhere. There's no one in the building. There's no animals. There's no houses closed. And so we went home, and I checked on, especially like EVPs that I didn't even hear, checked on photos where it showed what appeared to be, you know, children in the hall or looking out from under a medical cart. A little boy named Ryan, we were taking photos in a hallway, and it was very dark, you know, and even with, you know, having our own lights with us, it seemed like something was obscuring the light. And so I worked on the pictures and tried to enhance a little bit and pull out details. And in that shadow, you could see kind of an outline of a face with two very bright eyes under a medical cart. And I was like, that is really strange. And I spoke to Tanya again, and I was like, take a look at this. Tell me what you see. And she's like, that's insane. And I'm like, okay, what are you seeing? I don't want to put anything in your head. She said, I see the eyes of a little, it looks like a little boy, and says, I know who that little boy was. And I'm like, okay. I said, well, we had a special needs kid. We'll call him Ryan. Mm-hmm. And he would always like to, you know, just like a small child would, you know, they cover their eyes. Okay. You can't see me, you know, very simple. And he would get under the medical carts, when they would do rounds, and then he would kind of jump out, boo, you know. He was probably in his teens, but he was like a small child mentally. And apparently he had passed away on site. And this had been some years back, but they had mentioned hearing and having different experiences on that particular hall that he died. And that was the hall he died on. And another thing that we heard about was the sounds of children moving around. We had the reports of a shadow, like a shadow person of a nun. And I'll tell you real quick about the sounds of children walking. We had a few members who smoked. So we were going in and out one door. Everything else was secure. We went out front, left voice recorders on the floor at certain strategic points because it was sort of in a T shape. It was a main hall and two connecting halls, one for the boys, one for the girls. Well, we had in the commons area, we set up, you know, X amount of voice recorders, and we started hearing like a slap, slap, or a clop, clop, you know, almost like a barefoot sound on concrete. You know how it is. The kids are running around the pool or summertime out on the sidewalk.
Sure.
And it was like kind of a Doppler effect. It would be like clop, 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 real loud, and then it goes clop, clop, as it was passing it. And we kept playing it back, and I was trying to mimic what was going to make that sound. And it sounds just like a kid, like, say they're riding a broom or a mop and acting like it was a horsey. And so, again, and it was so funny because we didn't hear this at the time. And so I contacted Tanya again and said, listen to this. I will tell you it sounds like someone walking. Or more so than walking. So we just listened to it. And then they listened to it and they said, and they mentioned a girl's name. And I said, what does that mean? He says, we had a girl here. She was older. She was in her 40s who would gallop around. She would prance almost like a little pony playing, you know, I mean, she didn't think she was a pony, but I mean, she just, that was how she entertained herself. Mm-hmm. And she would get going from one end of the hall, man, all the way down to the other end of the hall and turn right back around. And just, that's how she would spend her time when she got to, you know, be out of her room and have exercise. She loved to prance about and do that. And come to find out, she also had died. I'm not thinking on site, but it was not long after she'd left. So I don't know if that means maybe a remnant or some part of her energy is there.
Yeah.
Because again, I never say this is a ghost, this isn't a whatever. I just report what people say and the sort of energy and stuff that I see or encounter. But yeah, Higgins had a large part to do with me writing this book because it wasn't until after that, and you know, like I said again, talking about there was a shadow figure of a nun where there had been a there had been a nun early on, back in the early part of the school when they would use like oil and like oil heaters. And the woman was in, I guess, still in her habit, you know, the long, like they said in the Blues Brothers, the penguin outfit.
Sure.
I mean it with all due respect. That's the only, yeah. That's the only reference I can throw.
I remember seeing them dressed like that as a child. So, yes.
Okay. Well, there you go. And like I said, again, I actually, one of our team members, Ricky, he was Catholic, and he gave me a blessed cross. And I'm friends of the Catholics, man. I have no problem with those guys, so please know that. But anyway, so this nun was trying to fill this up. They had had something going on. I think it was winter, obviously, and something happened. Either snow was pushing in a part of a roof, or they had to clear something, and they just did not get back in time to fill the oil up. Well, of course, it had just ran out. Well, this thing was hot, and instead of waiting an hour or whatever to give it time to cool down, because the kids were very cold, this is back when the children were there, she went ahead and tried to put the oil in. Well, if anybody's ever used a Jenny, or, you know, that's the first thing, you know, oh, no, give it, let it cool off. You may have a flashback, or it ignite the gases. Anyway, unfortunately, that's what happened, and it startled the lady. She kind of stepped back. She spilled some on her habit, and whoosh, she went up. Other nuns were able to put it out, but as I understand, she suffered such horrendous injuries that she ended up passing. Well, that in itself is a horrible thing. But then 7 years later, there was a sort of a legend, or a, you know, you had to kind of take it as legend, because up until then, no one had really, in the modern era, had seen it, that they would see a shadow of a nun. And, well, there was a couple people who had seen this image in this shape, because it wasn't like it moved across the wall. It was like a semi-solid black form. That's why I call it a shadow. It didn't look like it had eyes or anything. It was just this large black form. And if it realizes that you see it, or if you move toward it, it would go from the upstairs, which is where the room was at, down the stairs, like, rapidly. It, like, doesn't even look like it's walking, and it would just go. And before we even started this, Tanya told me, she said, look, I'm going to tell you something, and I'm not clowning with you. I'm dead serious. I'm like, okay, what? You know, she said, if you see an image, especially like a shadow, what looks like a nun or whatever, if you see a shadow, don't take after it. I'm like, okay, cool. What's up? And she said, well, we've had two people do that in the last, I think it was 10 or 12 years. Both, one was an engineer and another was one of the, teachers or overseers. Both had met with some unusual death within 6 months of the time. And I'm like, oh, come on. She says, no, seriously. I mean, I'm just telling you, do not do this, because they kind of knew us. And I'm like, okay. But which I spoke to other people after, even after that, kind of said, you know, do you know anything about it? And they said, well, that was what the legend was. And yeah, we knew of so-and-so supposedly had passed. So I'm not one for dealing with curses and stuff, you know, because I'm like, come on, it's a Scooby-Doo. But apparently there was something dark there that didn't want to be messed with. And I'm sure it was not a nun. I'm sure it was something that was, you know, assuming the form, as it were. And but like I said, again, that's the sort of weird stuff that drew me to it, because, you know, after we did that investigation, and then I dug into more learning about the Hart brother people, you know, the murderers, because what happened was, I'll tell you this, they took these men, because they were like raping, pillaging people. They were highwaymen. They would take the bodies, stuff them full of rocks and dirt, throw them out into the Wabash River, which is right on the edge of Union County. And I think it, I'm blanking on the next county, but there's three rivers that converge, and it blocks the Union from, I think it's Webster. Anyway, a lot of their crimes connected to Webster, and they would grab people off boats. So they took them. They, as understood, they hanged them, shot them, and beheaded them. I guess to make sure they're really dead. I guess one killing wasn't enough. But yeah. So they took their heads. I don't know if any of you guys watch Walking Dead. I don't give any spoilers. But
are we going back to last week's episode?
Yeah, exactly. Just like The Walking Dead.
Yeah.
And they had their heads on spikes.
Oh, God.
In front of the courthouse. Yes. And this is, you know, colonial times, hard times. So you got to have hard rules. And they, and as a message of don't do this, this is what you'll get. And then they turned around after the head started to rot, because, you know, heads rot. And they took them and they put it just over the river in Union County, facing Union County, as a message of going, because you understand, it was like a Manson family. They would grab girls and women. They would rape them, beat them, demoralize them. They would get like, what's the syndrome where you connect with your aggressor? They became part of the pack. Okay. So, you know, there you are dealing with the aftermath of brutality, and they still had some of the women out there. Oh.
Traumatic.
Sorry, that's our turn. That's our turn. You may want to give it a second. And I'm inside.
And you're going to tell me next there's no train track. The train track's been abandoned for years.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I was going to say the next thing you're going to tell me is the track's been abandoned for years.
No, actually, there is a really interesting story about this track in front of my house, which I need to write a story about. There was a guy named Peg Leg Locke who was an honest-to-God hobo. He would drive, he'd ride to town on the trains in the 60s and 70s, probably all the way back in the 50s. He was here. He was just a staple. And he would come and do yard work, anything, paint a barn, get a couple bucks, whatever. He was simple. Kind of think of Mice and Men. He was a strong guy, do a lot of hard work. And a lot of times before the next trains that go back to wherever he was from, he would stay on the train yard at night. Now, the bulls, which is the guys who oversee the yard, kind of gave him a little leeway. He didn't steal anything. And in fact, it kind of kept people from messing around because, you know, they knew he was a little different. Well, he would make fires, keep himself warm, you know, small fire. And then as it got late, he would scratch out all the embers, lay a piece of cardboard down over the warm ground, put a piece of wool blanket down and lay on it and cover himself up, and the earth would keep him warm overnight, generally. But what happened one night, it was a particularly cold night, and Tony, he didn't make it, and he ended up dying. They rushed him to the Caldwell County Medical Center, mm-hmm. and he died of exposure. But to this day, there's an overpass I can take you to where a bunch of convergence of train tracks are. And I always watched it as a kid because I always heard stories of certain nights when the weather's right, that first cold of winter or the last real cold of spring, you'll see a man either with a fire or walking with like a lantern, like a hobo lantern, mm-hmm. you know, made out of tin cans, walking down the track. And hand to God, you can look up online. There was a song called The Ballad of Peg Leg Locke. And that's my hometown.
Wow.
Princeton, Kentucky.
That's a great train track story. I've always found walking around train tracks ever since I was a kid. It's kind of a neat, haunting thing. I never knew why I was drawn to it, but there's always just something about it.
There's a romance. I mean, everyone forgets that, a Christmas Carol. Everybody knows that.
Yeah.
And it's a Christmas story, but I mean, it's a ghost story. Mm-hmm. But the author had a story about a man on the tracks. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to remember the name at the moment, but it was a really, really great story. And it resonated with me, and it always kind of stuck in my mind. And then as I got older and I heard that story, I'm like, so we've kind of got a real, you know, Dickens story in our town.
Yeah.
You know? But you know, again, that's the sort of thing that made me want to go out and talk about these different little communities because they've got all these bizarre stories that are normal to them.
Yeah.
But everyone else is, they haven't heard of it. Of course,
yeah.
They've heard of Waverly. Of course, they've heard of, Eastern State Prison, things like that. But they don't know anything about this area because, A, no one writes about it
mm-hmm.
Until me. And then it's just one of those, you know, PR. You know,
yeah.
If you don't, it doesn't matter how good the meal is. If you don't put it in a restaurant and bring all the people in, probably they won't eat it. So it took X amount of how many hundreds of years for me to come on to do it. So there it is. But that back to the hauntings of the St. Vincent's Academy.
Yeah.
As we were talking about the gentlemen who had their heads put on pikes and their heads were put across the river, as time went along, there are certain areas, and I'm sure you remember this as a young guy, like to prove your mettle, maybe you've got to walk into the old Smithers house, or maybe you've got like we had a mausoleum that you used to have to kind of talk into and ask something to come, you know, talk to you or, you know, come grab you or try to come get you. And you have to do it at stroke of midnight. You know, it's real, very dramatic. And
sure.
The area where the Hart brothers' heads were is one of such areas. And people would report seeing these large, brutish figures. Well, first you don't see them. First thing you hear is the gurgling wheeze of the separated necks from the heads trying to breathe out words in Welsh or whatever, cursing the people that murdered them and trying to find their heads. And then some people say that sometimes you'll see disembodied heads floating around. I mean, it's freaky. And so, again, that's why I had to put it in the books. You know, it's never touched on the paranormal side of it. And there's definitely a paranormal side. I mean, that's what most people remember, at least in this area. Mm-hmm. They know the paranormal side. I mean, there's a certain amount of people that know, oh, these are really bad guys, and they were mercenaries and bad guys. But they didn't know, I guess, they kind of had their own hell on earth to, if I can say that, to sort of pay for their crimes and their sins. So,
sure. When let's talk about the academy itself, and what is this all made up of? Because I know you mentioned a couple of different facilities. It sounds like it all kind of make up what is St. Vincent Academy. Is that correct?
Right. Well, I mean, St. Vincent's Academy was sort of a centralized school, and all of these things were satellites of and connected with. So if anybody who was there would be connected with the St. Anne's Church. And anybody connected with St. Anne's Church would be connected probably with Higgins, because it was, you know, a lot of the people who did work there were still connected to the old facility, even up to the point that it became a state-ran facility, which that was by the time we were able to get in. They were doing they basically shut it down, and they transferred the people out because there weren't enough people at that time. Most of them had passed. And that's how we were able to get in there, in that transit. So we got permission from the groundskeeper to be able to do this. You know, anybody's listening, please don't sneak into places. Please don't do that. Just go through the channels. It'll be worth it, and you'll enjoy yourself without watching the door and being scared someone's going to grab you.
So this whole thing, is St. Vincent Academy as it was shut down, no longer in operation?
Right. Well, I mean, it's pretty much at this point, the St. Vincent's is in remnants.
Okay.
It's dilapidated, falling in, more or less abandoned.
Okay.
For better, more updated property. Just like, you know, you have like a place that's covered in asbestos and, you know, not insulated. They're going to get better building and insulating techniques, and they're not going to retrofit that. There's no point.
Sure. Where you had mentioned that there was some people who were talking about patients that they had in recent times. That's why I was just trying to get an idea on the timeline of when did it shut down? When was the end of St. Vincent as an academy?
Well, the St. Vincent's itself, I believe, was still operating up until probably the 70s or 80s.
Okay.
Higgins Learning Center, which is where we did our main investigation, the initial investigation, started in the 70s, and it ran in some form or another until, you know, maybe 6 months before we went in there. So luckily we got in there, energy was still fresh. I mean, there were still beds in there and, you know, some personal items that were left and things. I mean, it was almost like a bug out. It was very, very abrupt.
Sure.
But now that is actually turned into a body shop. I'd spoke to the owners. I will not say their names because they don't want me to say a whole lot.
Sure.
But I will say that when I spoke to the owner, who didn't want to do an interview, but he did tell me, yeah, my wife will not go there at night. It's got a really freaky feeling. And especially as they were renovating it and taking out walls and turning it into where they can pull large vehicles in and whatnot. They said it was hard. It was the feeling was very, I won't say negative, but it was more like, what are you doing to our home?
Sure.
And as of beyond that, I've not heard. Guy got kind of tight-lipped once he realized I was writing the book, and that's fine. I respect that. But I will go on what he had said before, which helped me validate that, it definitely had lingering things going on, which if you look at, there's a story about Slack Farm. Slack Farm is not too far from that area, maybe 2 miles, still in the Morganfield area. And there was a Mississippian, I'm sure I'm saying that wrong, the Calhoun Indians, where they made our Native Americans that made the mounded burial mounds.
Sure.
And, you know, there had been just a large, very large community, one of the largest on the Wabash, coming down Ohio River. And the reason it was called Slack Farm, there's a the people who owned it for years were the Slack family. And one of the people who were after the Slack family took over it were approached by supposed archaeologists, and I'm doing air quotes here. Mm-hmm. And they said, well, okay, we'll pay you $1,000 a head, meaning there's like 10 or 12 of us. We'll each pay you $1,000 for us to excavate, look for pottery, jewelry, different things like that to secure for ourselves. And, you know, we'll make sure not, you know, we'll put everything back and whatnot, not all kinds of promises. Well, these people, ghouls basically, went through and, yeah, they looked for jewelry, any pottery, things like that. They found those broken, you know, just where they threw them down by the river. They didn't care about the history. They wanted what they could sell. And one of the things, unfortunately, that they could sell on black market was, you know, bones.
Oh, God.
Women, children, I'm talking skulls. I mean, they were selling fingers. Didn't matter. Whatever they could sell. And there was someone, I think, connected to the First Nations, and I may be wrong, and if so, I'm sorry, but one of the larger organizations, and this is back in the 70s, and they got wind of it because somehow or another, I mean, there was no internet. You know, people talk and people whatever. Anyway, someone said, hey, this is pretty ghoulish, and you might want to do something about it or be aware of it. And up to that time, there was zero protection for Native American graves. They were just kind of like, well, just, you know, till it up or do whatever. If you're putting a farm down, just whatever. You can stick it up. You find some arrowheads, stick it on your wall. But now it's like, hey, you do that, you know, we've got to come in here and shut it down. You can't use the property. Sure. And so anyway, there was a big court case. It actually went to the Supreme Court. I mean, it set a precedent. I mean, you can look it up today. But the strange thing is there had always been some reports of, like, watchers or protectors. Later on, especially after all this went down, which everything was put back that they could collect, they rededicated the ground, and basically it's sort of almost a protected area. I know there's some areas around that area that they still use for farming, but it's very strange. And there's reports of different kind of animals, anything from a Bigfoot type animal to kind of a dogman type animal. I don't think I'm over exaggerating when I say it's almost sort of like the Kentucky Skinwalker Ranch. Mm-hmm. It's very, very, very weird about it. And, you know, it's just disappeared. I mean, it's not like, hey, come visit and make it. I mean, that would be a touristy thing, you know, look at the mounds and, you know, like, what community probably wouldn't on a small end want to do that to make some money, but they're very weird with it. But ever since then, you know, they've had reports of Bigfoot. They've had reports of dogman. They've had reports of all kinds of different, you know, different stuff, you know, native drums beating and whatnot. Mm-hmm. And there was a man that was hunting. This is back not too long after this went down. He was with a friend of his. They brought two hunting dogs, like coon dogs. And they had, I don't know if you hunt or know anybody that hunts, but a lot of times guys in the back of the truck, they'll have like a little, like a temporary transport thing. You know, it's got like little doors on it. They can let them out the back of the truck and they jump off the tailgate and whatnot. Well, they had the dogs in that. So they went hunting and everything was fine. Well, as they went going down further, following game closer to Slack Farm, they started getting weird noises, started smelling smells, almost like a, you know, like a skunk ape. And one dog took clean off after something, and it didn't come back. They'd heard some, like it was fighting something. They heard a yelp and then didn't hear anything else. Well, the other dog, of course, it's going to go because they run in pairs, ran to get after whatever. And this time, whatever it was kind of took off. So they were trying to find the one dog. They couldn't even find the one dog that either died or something happened to it. It's gone. They did find some blood, and they couldn't find the other dog. And they looked for a while because good coon dogs are expensive and takes a long time to train. So, well, they searched until it was almost, you know, probably like 9 o'clock. I mean, it was getting late. And they said, here, man, we'll just have to come back, deal with it tomorrow maybe, or maybe it'll come home. So they go to their car, or the truck rather, and they see something under the car. And it was one of the dogs. It was the second dog. It's shaking. It's just beside itself. It's more or less it had like PTSD. It wouldn't hunt anymore. It was done. They were almost had to fight it to get it, you know, out from under the truck. Mm-hmm. Well, they go finally get this into the car, and they're like, man, what's wrong with this dog? They close up the tailgate, and there's like three or four large slashes in the back of the truck bed. I mean, I'm talking old school, like an old school GMC truck, like actually made of metal, 1970s. And it was I don't know if it was like sliced all the way through, but it was pretty deep cuts into it. There was nothing around the area. There was no fallen trees. There was nothing that would indicate that this had anything connected to anything other than some strange creature. As far as I know, they did not collect any fur from it. Or, you know, I think they were going, oh, that's extremely weird. Let's get the blank out of here.
Yeah.
And it took years. There was a lady that worked in one of the nursing homes, and she knew this guy. And because I was asking about this farm, it made a connection in her head. I knew a guy who talked about hunting down here, and he told me this crazy story. And I said, well, maybe it had something to do with the Guardians of Slack Farm. I don't know. So that's what's really odd, is that you have ghosts, you have weird shadow things, you have, you know, all the stuff about, you know, EVPs and children, ghosts of children. Then you have cryptids on top of it.
Yeah.
I'm like, this is nuts. It's like, is it Mira Hellmouth or something? Is this Buffy? What in the world's going on? And, you know, as I was riding, I'm like, you know, sometimes stuff is so crazy. I'm going, well, it's, you know, because I release it as fiction, but based on true events and true stories,
mm-hmm.
you know, stories given to me. Because I'm like, look, some of these stories are so outlandish, but you have so many people that back it. And then you look up, you know, and I research about Slack Farm, and oh, that actually happened. Desecrations actually happened. And people always talked about it being kind of a funny, sacred, kind of, I'm going to say pet cemetery-ish, but quirky and weird, and that kind of, like, you have a reverence, and it's not stick around here. So, you know, I guess it kind of all tied together to equal that one thing. But again, that's why I felt the need to write about it, because there was actually another facility that's closer to me. It's not 14 miles. Well, it wasn't 14 miles. It's demolished now, called Outwood,
mm-hmm.
in Dalton Springs. It's just not far from Princeton. And I could not get enough visual confirmation of the building, because I always want to have good descriptions of everything, down to what flicker or what flicks of whatever is in the old school type floor, you know, flooring of the building. And sadly, that facility got knocked down. The main old building got knocked down probably 30 years ago. And all the old timers that had worked there, most of them are dead or gone.
Mm-hmm.
So, and then when I just, you know, I never meant to write about this book. It just fell into my lap. You know, when you have things like that, and you have seemingly demonic creatures, you know, because there was a chapter talking about in the old St. Vincent's, mm-hmm. that was dilapidated. Somebody went there playing around looking for just whatever. I don't know if what they were doing in there exactly. But people would go in there and hang out, curious people. And they had a very black, like a tarish looking figure. And when you would say anything regards of like religious, had any sort of iconography, you know, icons, or said any kind of prayer, you know, Hail Mary and all that, it would start talking Latin back to you. But it would, you know, it would say some messed up stuff in Latin. So it was very weird. It was very, you know, I've never dealt with things like that. I've dealt with haunted, you know, people having problems in their homes that are haunted. I've went to places where, you know, children have died or whatnot, and you deal with children's spirits and whatnot. I've been in places where they talked about there being cryptids and things, but I'd never dealt with something that condensed,
mm-hmm.
in such a small amount. You know, no wonder they don't want to talk about it.
That wraps up part one of our interview with Stephen Asher about St. Vincent Academy. In part two, we'll talk about the ghost children lingering downtown near St. Anne's Church that just looked off. And why are they there? Why is this small town such a hotbed of paranormal activity? We'll dig into that further. Is there a connection between the hauntings and the disturbed burial grounds of the area? And do the people of the city believe that their town is a hotbed of paranormal activity, as those who look into? All that and more in part two. To hear it, become a Gravekeeper. That's a supporter of our program. For $5 a month, you will get access to part two of this interview, as well as part two to all of our interviews, and advanced access to our show months before they are released to the public in their entirety. Just go to patreon.com/thegravetalks to become a grave keeper and keep our program on the air. That's patreon.com/thegravetalks, or go to our website, thegravetalks.com. The link is there for you as well. Until next time, for The Grave Talks, I'm Tony Bruschi. Thanks for listening.